Once again, thank you very much for coming out this morning. And again, a thank you to Jordan Max for sponsoring our learning this morning in memory of his mother, whose yard site is today, Sarah Elka Bas Avraham HaKohen. Russell spoke about a more halachic topic. I'm going to be a little bit more geared towards hashkafa and a major philosophical point. We have many reasons why we are attracted to the land of Israel, why we try to go back. But I'd like to add a new level, one that is rooted in Tanakh and rooted in Medrash, as we'll see, but which has really been developed most powerfully by the more Kabbalistic writers of the past few centuries, particularly Rav Yisachar Techtel. A little bit of background on Rav Techtel. Rav Techtel was originally from Hungary. He was a major figure in Czechoslovakian Jewry in the first part of the 20th century. He was an opponent of Zionism for most of his career. He was an Ab Beis Din, head of the Beis Din, as well as Rosh Hashiva in Czechoslovakia for 25 years before World War II. He wrote Tshuvot, responsa called Mishneh Sachir, which are now being brought to press. Some of them are already published. During the war, initially he hid in Budapest, and then he fled the Nazis to Slovakia. He was rounded up in 1944 and sent to Auschwitz. He was actually killed defending a Jew on a transport when the Jew's bread was taken from him by a Ukrainian. And during the war itself, he changed his opposition to Aliyah. He wrote about how the opposition was a mistake, and he writes very poignantly and really, you know, for me, in a tear-jerking way, about how his error and the error of his mentors and the error of those who stood with him led to the loss of thousands, if not millions, of lives. And so he writes in a work called Eim HaBanim Smecha, which I'm going to quote quite a bit here, about the imperative for us to return to Israel, and for the religious and secular Jews there to work together to build up the land. And today I want to look at his unique explanation for why the Jew should return it to Israel. There are lots of reasons for Aliyah. There are lots of reasons for a Jew to go back to the land. Putting the question out here, what would be reasons for the Jew to return to the land of Israel? It's our home. What does that mean? I'll come back to the mitzvah in a second. Yeah.
One place is unquestionably not part of the government.
Well, some would dispute that, wouldn't they? The idea that perhaps it has an association with our history. It's the place where our ancestors were. It's the place where our ancestors are buried. The birthplace of our nation. If you take a look on your sheet, see a fascinating idea that Rav Yehuda Alkalai developed along those lines. It's in source number 5. Rav Yehuda Alkalai pointed out an odd phenomenon in the Torah. Yaakov fights a war with his brother Esav on his way back from the land of Aram, the house of Laban, into Israel. Right? Or he prepares to fight a war with his brother Esav. In the end, there is no war. They seem to be at peace with each other, and they go their own way. Right? We're familiar with the story? Yaakov then goes back home to encounter his family again, to meet his father Yitzhak. But along the way, he stops off in the city of Shechem. Right? We remember the story? What does Yaakov do in Shechem before the incident with Dina? What does Yaakov do? No one notices. I don't notice either when I read it every year. Every year we get to the parsha, and I completely skip that pasuk. I mean, physically I read the words. But really it gets lost, because you're coming from this great dramatic encounter with his brother Esav. Is there going to be a fight? Is there not going to be a fight? His brother kisses him. Is he serious? Is he sincere? Is he not? And then you come to the next story, and that's Dina in the city of Shechem. And that's a story that grabs you. And so there's a pasuk in the middle that, speaking for myself, I tend to ignore. And that's the pasuk that says, Vayiken Yaakov, Yaakov purchased a portion of land in Shechem. We read it and it's sort of pedestrian, but it doesn't make sense. Yaakov doesn't plan to live in Shechem. Yaakov is on his way home to see his father he hasn't seen in 20 plus years. Right? His mother, Rivka, passed away while he was on the road. At least he's going to get to see his father Yitzchak. Yaakov has no plan to stay in Shechem. Why in the world is Yaakov buying land in a place he doesn't plan to live? If he's a land speculator, I might recommend some other places in Israel. Nablus is not really the first one that I would recommend. Take a look at source number 5, where Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai develops the very interesting idea. Based on Ramban's idea of Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, that which our ancestors do is a sign for us, he says, we are meant to buy land in Israel, and Yaakov is charting the way. He says, such an idea is hinted at in the Torah, and Yaakov came in peace to the city of Shechem, and he bought the parcel of ground where he spread his tent. Why did Yaakov buy the land if his only intention was to rest there for a time and then continue on to see his father Yitzchak? It is apparent that this act was realized to teach his descendants that the redemption would come about by purchasing the land from its inhabitants. Because he bought the parcel of land, it was as if he lived permanently on it. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai is very interesting as an early voice in the movement to actually buy back land in Israel and use that as a basis for Jewish settlement there. But the core idea is indeed, as you're saying, Israel is a place of special historic significance to our nation. It's a place where we belong. That's one. And then a second idea perhaps is the idea that there is a mitzvah of aliyah, a mitzvah for a Jew to actually return to Israel. That's a great other topic that we could have a nice long discussion about. Whether there's a mitzvah, is it a mitzvah, is it a meta mitzvah? The second point, what else? Why else would a Jew want to return to Israel? There are certain mitzvahs you can only do in Israel. Truma, Maaser, the Maaser Sheni discussion that Russell just had, whether that's only in Israel, good. And in general, it's a place of spiritual centrality. Hashem says, this is the place where I will be close to you. If you take a look at source number 1, Hashem says, Po Eshev Ki Ivisiha, here I will dwell, for I have desired her. Source number 3, the Medrash in the Sifri says that you are going to be evicted from the land of Israel, you will quickly be lost, and you shall place these words, you shall tie tefillin, you shall keep the words of the Torah in your heart. Even though I exile you from the land, Hashem says, be marked by your mitzvot, so that when you return, they will not be new for you. What is the purpose of mitzvot performed outside of Israel?
Practice.
Exactly. So you can continue doing them when you get back to Israel. It's funny, I gave a shiur on Shabbos. I was in Hamilton over Shabbos. And I gave a shiur there on the question of is aliyah a mitzvah, is aliyah a meta mitzvah. And as I used that source, and I flashed on a memory from when I lived in Allentown. It's a little crude for the topic, but it's a good way to bring it home if we have basketball fans here. You may recall a once and then second time Philadelphia 76er by the name of Allen Iverson, the fellow with an awful lot of promise that never quite delivered. But there was one time when he missed a practice. Right? You remember what I'm talking about? He missed a practice. And he was asked about it during an interview. And he went on a 10-minute rant. Practice? It's just practice. That's all. 53 times. 53 times he mentions the word practice in this rant about it's just practice. The idea is that practice isn't that important. And the Sifri says, and Ramban develops the idea, our mitzvahs performed outside of the land of Israel are practice. I don't know how many mitzvahs Iverson does, but the idea is that in fact the land of Israel is a place of special merit for us. It's a place where we have a special association with Hashem. There's more. I brought more sources on the sheet than I plan to actually recite out loud, but you can see them there. That's another reason why we return. Another reason we return is that it's a means of actually bringing about the time of Mashiach. That there's a requirement for Jews to return to Israel. This is an idea developed by Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai in a major way. You can see it in source number 8. You can see it in source number 9. He talks about returning to the land of Israel as a means of triggering a time of Mashiach. When we say that Hashem should return, upon whom should the Shekhinah be manifest? Hashem should be manifest upon what? Sticks and stones and the like? No, you need people there. He develops the idea at length. Another reason to return to the land of Israel is simply that it should be a safe haven, a place where Jews will be free. It's kind of ironic when we look at it from our end, the beginning of the 21st century. But recall that in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a notion that by creating a land of our own and Jews would just go to that land, we would end anti-Semitism. I'm not so sure that the polling numbers bear that out at this point, but it was an idea, it was a theory. The view was, though, and the view still is to a certain extent, that it's a safe place to be. It was very interesting. When I was in Hamilton over Shabbos, I heard Rabbi Donnie Green speak. And he talked about an event he had attended at which they showed videos. It was a support event for Israel during the Gulf War. And they showed videos representing the American forces who were there. They showed a video for the Canadian forces who were there and a video for the Israeli forces who were there. And they sang the national anthem for each. And he pointed out that in the American anthem, they showed pictures of the Statue of Liberty and the Grand Canyon, all the natural wonders of the U.S. and symbols of patriotism. And then they did the Canadian anthem, and they showed the Canadian Rockies, and they showed the tundra, and they showed also the beauty of Canada. And then they had the Israeli video, and it was tanks and jets and soldiers. His talk was about what we dream about for our land. But but it's true that for many Jews, many, many Jews, the significance of the land is the idea that here we have a place we can defend, here we have a place that will be a haven. All of these are certainly legitimate reasons to return to the land, bringing about Mashiach, the spiritual centrality, the mitzvah aspect, historic significance for our nation is where we belong. All of these are important. But beyond these, look at the following evidence, please, and tell me what you see. It's the second side of the first page. I bring you two psukim, two sentences from Yeshaya. Vatomer Tzion Azavani Hashem, source number 10, Vashem Shechechani. And Tzion said, Hashem has abandoned me, and Hashem has forgotten me. Who is the speaker? Yerushalayim, Tzion. Tzion we usually identify with Yerushalayim at its core, good. Source number 11, another pasuk from Yeshaya. Hashem speaking to somebody. You shall no longer be called abandoned, and your land will no longer be called desolate, for you will be called, my desire is in her. Chefzi ba. You will be called, my desire is in her. To whom is Hashem addressing this comment? Israel. It's the land of Israel. So we could look at this and take it as a statement about the land that's really meant as a metaphor. Right? We could say it's a metaphor. It's not really about an entity, the land of Israel, that's thinking. However, Rabbi Yisachar Tachtel disagreed, as did others among the more Kabbalistic religious Zionist writers. Take a look at source number 12, a comment from Rav Kook in Orot. He says, Eretz Yisrael einena davar chitzoni, kenyan chitzoni le'uma. The land of Israel is not an external thing, an external prize acquired by the nation, a means toward the end of national unification and reinforcement of the nation's physical, even spiritual survival. Rav Kook says, we can't make the mistake of thinking of the land of Israel as sort of the scenery, the backdrop, where we live out our national destiny. We are going to become a unified nation, we are going to become a more spiritual nation, we will be a safe nation, and it'll take place at these coordinates on earth. Rav Kook says it doesn't work that way. Rather, he says, the land of Israel is an independent entity bound to the nation in the bond of life. He says, it is a mate for the Jewish people. The land of Israel is an active partner in our relationship. That's the way Rav Kook saw it, and that's the way Rav Tachtel saw it. Now, that leads me to two questions. One question is, what do you really mean when you anthropomorphize land? What exactly does that mean when we say the land is an entity, a partner with us? And then number two, we're going to see that the land of Israel in particular is painted as a mother. And I want to know what that means when the Torah paints land as a mother. So first of all, in terms of anthropomorphization, which is a really hard word, but I think I got it right. Anthropomorphization, I'll say it again. What does that mean in the context of land? Well, we do that in the Torah. Take a look at source 15. Pasuk which we say Shabbos morning in Pesukei Dezimra, the opening part of davening, Hashamayim Misafrim Kavod, Kelo Maaseh Yadav Magid Arakia. The heavens speak of the glory of God, the deeds of His hands are told by the skies. That's the heavens and the skies, which we usually don't think of as being animated and having a life of their own. That's one example. But of land specifically, take a look at source 14, when it's commenting on an odd apparent conflict between Psukim. When the Torah describes the creation of the trees, it says that Hashem told the land to produce eight pri, but when the trees are actually produced, it says that the land produced eight oseh pri. What does eight pri mean? Eight pri. Well, fruit tree.
Right. Tasting trees themselves.
Ah, so we have a Medrash expert. In and of itself, I don't think Rashi and the Medrash would have been bothered had the Pasuk said, create, Hashem says to the ground, bring forth eight pri, and the ground brought forth eight pri. We would have said eight pri means fruit tree. And just like when I talk about fruit trees, I don't mean trees that are edible, right? I mean a tree that produces fruit. That's what I would have said eight pri meant. That would have been my way to read it. However, when the trees are actually produced, it says eight oseh pri. Right, trees that could produce fruit. So the Medrash is bothered and said, is it eight pri? Yes. Oseh pri. That's in Hashem's request. Correct, correct. I was being less precise for brevity, but you're right. The initial command that Hashem gives is produce eight pri oseh pri limineu. And instead it says the batotei haaretz, the ground brought forth eight oseh pri. There are a few more words in between, but we'll go with that. So the Medrash asks the question, and the Medrash says that later on Hashem curses the land when Adam and Chava eat from the tree. Hashem curses the land. The land is not an innocent bystander. The land was deserving of a punishment from before. Why was the land cursed in source 14? Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Shalom said, she trespassed Hashem's command. Hashem said, let the land produce vegetation, etc., meaning that just as the fruit is edible, so the tree should be edible. And she did not do this. The land didn't do what it was instructed to do. Well, if land is just an inanimate, unconscious entity, what in the world are you talking about? The land decided to do otherwise. It felt, you know what, I know God said this, but I have a different way of doing things. We can accept that regarding Adam and Chava. We can accept that regarding Moshe. Moshe is credited with a few innovations of his own. But land? It's not a straightforward idea, at least in my book. Take a look at source 15, Yaakov's stones. Right? Remember the story? Yaakov goes to sleep, and he takes from the stones of the place to put by his head. There's some debate as to whether it's under his head, around his head, but it says Vayikach me'avnei hamakom. He took from the stones of the site, and when he gets up, it said that he took es ha'eben asher samara shosav, the stone that he had had by his head, that he had placed by his head. So in the beginning it was plural, then it became singular. How do we understand that it was plural at the start and singular at the end? So the Medrash informs us, it's source 15, I'm quoting from the Gemara, there's a slightly different version that appears in Gracious Rabbah. It is written, and he took from the stones of the site, and it is written, and he took the stone. Rabbi Yitzchak explained, this teaches that all of the stones were gathered to one place, and each one said, this tzaddik will rest his head on me. We learned all of them became absorbed into one. They started out as many stones, and then they came together. People have a harder time with this than rocks do, evidently. But the idea is that the stones have some kind of consciousness. They desire to be near and to serve Yaakov. Again, ascribing consciousness to the mineral kingdom. an odd thing. Source number 16, I brought another example. I don't need to go through it all in depth inside, but you can see the source there. The Torah says that Hashem creates es shnei ha-me'oros ha-gadolim, the two great luminaries, and then it says ha-me'or ha-gadol and the ma'or ha-katan, the great luminary, the sun, and the small luminary, the moon. How did that happen? And so we get the story of Hashem shrinking the moon, because the moon complains you shouldn't have two kings with the same crown, and Hashem says, okay, fine, I'll keep it for the sun. You can go take control of the nighttime if you like. There's this trend towards ascribing consciousness to minerals. How does this actually work? So you can give a few different answers. One answer is, potentially, everything Hashem creates wants to serve, wants to accomplish an end. Not wants to in the sense of there's a desire there, actively I want to serve, but wants to in the sense that by its very nature, this is what it's meant for. But I have a hard time with that here because these are all examples of disobedience, except for the stones. But the example of the sun and the moon, the example of the land that didn't produce the right kind of trees, these are examples of disobedience. You could suggest that everything actually has a consciousness on some kind of a minimal level, whatever it is. But yeah, there's some level of free will, believe it or not, in the ground. There's another possibility, which is that there are malachim, angelic forces for lack of a better term, that are actually associated with everything that Hashem created. Just as we are taught, I believe I brought it here on the sheet. No, I believe incorrectly. We are taught that every nation is represented in the heavens by a malach. There is an angel that represents each community of human beings descended from a given ancestor. So too, there are malachim that represent the land itself, and the moon, and the stars, and the light. This is not so odd. When you read the Rambam's cosmology about the spheres, that idea comes across as well, that there are actually, Hashem creates intelligent beings that are associated with these different entities. Not necessarily a malach specifically, the word malach is a little bit loaded, but it's the idea of an intelligence. And when it comes to the land of Israel, the intelligence associated with the land is a maternal personality. And so I come to our second question. What does motherhood represent in the Torah? What do you think of when you think of mothers within the Torah? What traits? Protective? Corrective? Like what? Can you give me an example? Well, I just want to know you're thinking of what a mother in the Torah and not a personal case. Prayer? What do you mean? Right, we think of Rivka davening for a child. We think of the tefillah of Rachel for her children. Right, protective, corrective prayer. Yes. Right, the mother framing the ideology of the family. Very much so. Yes. Seichel. Right. This more than seichel, I would say insight. Right? And she has a certain instinct. You get in trouble for saying intuition, but that may be the word. Sarah also is credited with something else. In that same story with Yishmael, Sarah is credited with, what does she have? Nevuah. Right? Sarah is credited with Nevuah, with prophecy. Yes?
Nurturing.
Takes us back towards the protective side. Can you give an example? Right. Can you give me a Tanakh example, though? We've been thinking Chumash, but there are a lot more mothers in Tanakh when you go beyond Chumash. Not all of them are the best examples. I'm thinking about Talia, who killed out her family. But there are always outliers, you know. It's true, certainly. I'm sorry?
Yes, correct.
Right.
So there's
Right. Well, the mothers are certainly protective in Tanakh, that's for sure. And the example of Sarah for Yitzchak is the most obvious one. Story 17. Ki lo yirash ben ha'amah hazos im b'nei im Yitzchak. For the son of this maid will not inherit with my son, with Yitzchak. To be a fly on the wall when she said that to Abraham. I want to know what the intonation was when she said that. More than that, Rivka for Yaakov, arranging for the birthright, right? Making sure that Yaakov would get not the birthright, but the bracha. Rachel for her children, source number 18, Hashem's response to Rachel when she cries on behalf of her children. And Hashem says, your children are going to come home. What about Bathsheba? People don't often talk about Bathsheba. She's the perfect example. If you're not familiar with the story, you open up Malachim Aleph, the first book of Kings, and read the first couple of chapters. She twice saves the Malchus, the kingdom of her son, Shlomo. First, when Adoniyahu tries to launch his coup, and she, along with Nasan Hanavi, comes to David and says, hey, you know, there's this little coup going on. Could you do something about it? You said my son Shlomo was going to become the next king. And then a second time, when Adoniyahu has been spared, and Adoniyahu tries to do an end run, trying to use Bathsheba, Adoniyahu underestimates Bathsheba. He thinks that he can turn her towards his task, and he asks her to convince Shlomo to allow him to marry some of David's concubines, former concubines, knowing that this will set him up as a potential king. And so she very cleverly doesn't oppose him directly and still manages to sabotage his plot with Shlomo. She manages to orchestrate everything perfectly to make sure that Adoniyahu falls and Shlomo survives. It's a brilliant move. If you take a look at those first couple of prakim, she's protecting her son. She also creates a home, she, the mother in Tanakh, creates a home that is conducive to spiritual growth. And that goes back to the point about the mother charting the ideology of the family. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source 19 regarding the tent of Sarah. Rashi makes the comment when Yitzchak brings Rivka ha'ohala Sarah imo to the tent of Sarah his mother. What's so special about it that it should be called Sarah's tent after she's already deceased? Rashi informs you, quoting the Medrash, as long as Sarah lived, the lamp was lit from Friday to Friday. The dough was blessed. A cloud remained attached to the tent. That's a good thing. Clouds are positives in this case. We're going to come back to the cloud in a moment. When Sarah died, these phenomena ceased. When Rivka came, they returned. What do you see in these three images? The lamp, the dough, and the cloud? I'm sorry? The Mishkan. Very good, right? That's the Mishkan. The lamp is the menorah. Lamp is the menorah. Although I guess you could point out the fire remaining on the Mizbeach. I think we generally would associate it with the menorah. The cloud is the Hashem's presence, the Anan on the Mishkan when Hashem speaks to Moshe, the direct communication from Hashem with humanity, and the dough is the Shulchan that has the bread, right? The showbread, Lechem Apanim. Exactly. These three symbols tie into that. Not only that, they also tie into three brachos the Jews received in the desert, right? The fire leading by night, the cloud leading by day, and the man. It's associated with those same three things. But the theme here, this very important theme of the menorah, the cloud, the shulchan, and the mishkan in general, tells us that she builds a home. It's identified not as Ohel Avraham, but as Ohel Sarah. Sarah builds, creates a home which has an association with Hashem on the level of a mishkan. That's a very serious statement. Yeah? Right, she's first. Good point, thank you. In general, we associate the Ohel with the woman who creates it. So that Yael is praised by Devorah, Minashim ba'ohel tivorach. She should be the blessed one among the women who created the Ohel. The Shlomo HaMelech says, Al titosh taras imecha. Do not reject the Torah of your mother, which we take in the Gemara to mean the Minhagim. That's what it's a reference to. If you think about the Eishes Chayil, right? Eishes Chayil is, of course, from the last chapter in Mishle, but who is the author of Eishes Chayil? Nope. Shlomo is the author of Mishlei. But if you look in the beginning of Esh Hayil, right before Esh Hayil starts, there in the 31st parak, you find that it's actually written by his mother. It's written by Bathsheba. And it's Bathsheba's description to Shlomo. I brought you one pasuk from it in source number 20. That's not the one that gives you the source. But the idea is, his mother tells him, this is the type of woman I want you to seek. Look for an Esh Hayil. Which is particularly interesting, because which woman is it in Tanakh who is called an Esh Hayil? Who is the woman who's called Esh Hayil in Tanakh? There's a specific woman. Rus. Rus is called by Boaz an Esh Hayil. And Rus is Shlomo's great-great-grandmother. So in other words, Bathsheba is saying to him, look for someone like Rus. And of course, the tragic irony is that Shlomo says, I never found it. Right? That's his line in Koheles. He says, Isha achas me'elef lo matzasi. In all the women whom he married, he was never able to replicate that. What he saw in his great-grandmother and what his mother described for him. But take a look at source number 20. Noda basharim bala bishivtoim ziknei aretz. Her husband is known at the gates where he sits with the elders of the land. This isn't a reference to the bar. The gates in Tanakh, the gates of the city, are the place where the Beis Din sits. It's where the judges sit. The elders sit in conference. Her husband is there. And it's credited to her. Leave aside the question of, well, why doesn't she get to sit with the elders at the gates? That's a great discussion. Totally not for today. But the point that I'm trying to create here is, the image of a mother in Tanakh is an image of protection and an image of spiritual growth. She provides a model for the family and a means for the family to achieve it. And taking that now and applying it to the land of Israel, Israel being known as the mother to the Jewish people, it's a land that cares for our well-being. It's a land that provides a place where we can grow spiritually, and in fact, it longs for our spiritual growth. Which brings me to my last point. The real association of Israel with motherlands. If you take a look at source 21, 21a I should say, because somehow or other I missed that I had another source right afterwards, the source in Gittin, which is too bad. But take a look at source 21. Rosemary George, writing in The Politics of Home. Home is a place to escape to and a place to escape from. Its importance lies in the fact that it is not equally available to all, right? It's my home. Home is the desired place that is fought for and established as the exclusive domain of a few. I thought that was a fascinating definition. But it's also passive. It's all about what I ascribe to the home. Right? What I associate with the home. The fact that there are only a few people who are welcome there is not a function of the home. It's a function of the people who inhabit it. The fact that it's a place that is fought for and established as the exclusive domain of a few is because of the people, not because of the home. What we are saying is that the land of Israel actually defines itself that way, as the exclusive domain of the few. That's our concept. If you see the source there, that's included right under 21. I didn't notice it when I was doing my translation, so I would have translated it there. I'll translate it now. We define Israel in Tanakh as Eretz Tzvi. Now, the most literal explanation of Eretz Tzvi is not the popular one. Tzvi, in Aramaic, and it creeps into Hebrew as well, you see it in Hebrew too, it's really from the Hebrew initially, is desire. Ratzon. When someone wants something, Onkelos translates it from the Torah as utziviat. She wanted. Eretz Tzvi is the land of Hashem's desire. Nonetheless, we also associate it with another translation of Tzvi, which is?
Deer.
The deer. Exactly. The deer. Eretz Tzvi, the land that is like a deer. Well, what does that mean? So the Gemara offers an explanation. Eretz Tzvi k'sivba. It is said regarding the land of Israel that is Eretz Tzvi, Ma Tzvi zeh ein oro machzik es besaro, just like the deer. The skin, the hide, does not contain the flesh. Meaning that if you've gone deer hunting, which I admit I never have, and if you've actually bagged a deer, which I certainly never have, nonetheless, he's informing you, and I take it at face value, that once you've stripped the hide, you would never be able to fit it back around the deer anymore. It just won't work. It shrinks and shrivels up. Ah, Eretz Yisrael, so to the land of Israel, Bizman Sheyoshev and Alea Ravcha, when we dwell in the land, then it extends itself and it's able to contain all of us. Ubizman She'en Yoshev and Alea Gamda, and when we're not living there, it shrivels up. Which we have testimony about time and time again in history. When the Jews have not lived there, it has indeed suffered. There's a prediction of it in Source 22, where Hashem describes the land resting when the Jews aren't there. But you heard the famous account from Mark Twain, right, in his visit at the end of the 19th century. He comes to the land and he says it's a desolate place. It was written up in Harper's Magazine back in those days. We also have a description by Emanuel Riki, who visits the land in 1718. And he says, yeah, all I saw were rocks, but the Jews who were coming back were developing it and the land was responding. The land responds when its inhabitants are there. It is an active matriarch. It's actually choosing to be the mother of the Jewish people. It's protecting us, and it is summoning us home. Now, that doesn't mean the land will not also be corrective. Take a look, please, at Source 23, a dire prediction if you misbehave. V'lo saki ha'aretz eschem b'tama'achem osa, lest the land spit you out when you contaminate it, as it spit out the nation who preceded you. So, there's that little corrective element, a little tough love coming from the land also. It's not a pushover. But fundamentally, the land longs for us to return. The land of Israel longs for us to be present. If you take a look at Source 24, beautiful medrash, Psikta Ravsi, recording Yirmiyah's conversation with a woman. Yirmiyah said, when I ascended to Yerushalayim, I raised my eyes and saw a woman sitting atop a mountain. Remember the story of Yirmiyah's return to Yerushalayim. Yirmiyah is out when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. He's been sent on a mission to Anatot. And then he comes back and it's leveled. The Beis HaMikdash is just smoke and ruins where the Beis HaMikdash was. The Rav of Soloveitchik used to describe this on Tisha B'Av before, as an introduction to the Kina of Shavas Surumeni. He would talk about how Yirmiyah comes back and just encounters desolation. And how tragic and painful it is. So Yirmiyah says, when I ascended to Yerushalayim, I raised my eyes and saw a woman sitting atop a mountain, wearing black clothing and with her hair undone, crying out, seeking one who would console her. I cried out as well, and sought one who would comfort me. I drew close to her and spoke with her and told her, if you are a woman, speak with me. If you are a spirit, leave me. She replied, do you not recognize me? I am the one who had seven sons, whose father left to go overseas. While I was yet crying for him, it was prophesied to me, the house has collapsed upon your seven sons and killed them. I don't know for whom to cry and for whom to release my hair. I replied and told her, you are no greater than my mother Tzion, who has been turned into grazing for the wild animals of the field. To which she replied and said to me, I am your mother Tzion. It's the land of Israel itself, Yerushalayim perhaps as Tzion, but it's the personality of it. The husband being Hashem, the seven sons being the Jewish people, and having been taken out of her midst, sent off into Galut, sent off into exile. Rav Techtel, who develops this idea in his Eim HaBanim Smecha, sees the positive too. There's a fascinating sentence in the Torah in which Hashem says to the Jewish people, I will remember my covenant with Yaakov, and I will remember my covenant, my bris with Yitzchak, and I will remember my covenant, my bris with Avraham, and I will remember the land. Well, what does that mean, I will remember the land? Aretz Eschem. I know the bris. Hashem made a bris with Avraham and said, your children are going to be slaves, they're going to come out, and there were promises about them becoming a mighty nation, and numerous as the stars. That I get. Ditto for the bris with Yitzchak, ditto for the bris with Yaakov. What is Hashem remembering about the land? Says Rabbi Yisachar Techtel, I have learned this in Source 25. From the Torah of our master Moshe himself, he quotes the Pasuk, it is written, I will remember my covenant with Yaakov, also my covenant with Yitzchak, also my covenant with Abram I will remember, and the land I will remember. Rashi there wrote, why are they listed in reverse? Rashi doesn't address the land. He addresses the Abram Yitzchak Yaakov part. Why are they listed in reverse? As if to say, Yaakov the youngest is worthy of this, of me bringing the Jews home. And if he's not worthy, then Yitzchak is with him. And if he is not worthy, then Abraham is with him. And that's where the Rashi ends. But Rav Techtel adds, based on this, one may add that even if all of them are unworthy, meaning that the merit of our ancestors has ended, still, the land I will remember. For the merit of the land of Israel itself will save them from trouble. But again, it's not a passive merit. She will protect us to free us whenever we are placed in trouble, heaven forbid. It's beyond metaphor. And this should make us think, perhaps, about the land as more than real estate, more than a political football, more than the backdrop for our nation to achieve some great height. Our religious worldview, in a very real sense, paints Israel as a persona. In terms of Aliyah, it makes it much more than just a return to a location. It's a return to someone who actually reciprocates our love. And in terms of Yom HaZikaron, as well as Yom HaAtzmaut, the idea that we're fighting for something real, for something alive, and that's part of what motivates the soldiers who give their lives for the land and whose lives we remember and honor on Yom HaZikaron. It's a very important, very powerful idea to me. I want to close with Rabbi Yisachar Techtel's naming of his book. I brought you the Hebrew as well as the English. The English can't do justice to the Hebrew. The English is just my own translation of it. There's a lot there, so I hope that people will read it. It really sums up to me the major points that we've made. Number one, the many reasons we want to return to Israel, all sorts of reasons why we want to be back there, whether as a mitzvah, whether because it's the place with historic significance for us as a people, whether it's a safe haven, whether it's the place we can do mitzvahs, whether it's a way to bring Mashiach, but in particular the idea of land as a personality and specifically as a mother, protective, providing its merit to help us. Yes, corrective. Yes, providing a home for us. Take a look at what he says here in this story, where he describes an event that he witnessed in 1942. Now, I have to tell you, I get choked up when I read this. I need somebody else to be the one to read this out loud. Someone who doesn't mind reading a lot, or we'll just do break it up in halves. Can someone else be the one to read this out loud? Someone? Thank you. Yeah.
It's not from the sages that our mother Zion cries and wails for us. We are her children, and she waits for us to return to her. With my own flesh, I saw God. In 1942, before Pesach, a horrifying decree was issued by the incursive wicked ones in Slovakia to kidnap Jewish girls from age 16 and up and bring them to a cruel land, an unknown place. Until today, the fate of thousands of pure Jewish souls who were brought there is unknown. God will avenge them quickly. There was then a great fear in the Jewish camp, and I know of one who wished to save his young daughters lest they fall into this wicked trap. And he tried to cross the border with his daughters. This was full of Lloyd Hazel, and he promised his wife that he could send a message by telegraph from across the border when he arrived, letting her know that he and his children had arrived safely at the destination. The mother sat in her house with her eyes failing with worry, anticipating at every moment the arrival of the happy news that they had crossed the border in peace and arrived in a safe place. But the father and his daughters were caught before they crossed the border, and they were brought to a city near the border and jailed all through Kolomoy and through the end of Pesach, and they were in great danger of being sent to a cruel land in accord with their practice of punishing for flight. Anyone who fled and was caught was sent to a cruel land in a manner which was yet more cruel than that used for others sent there. This became known to his wife, to the mother of the daughters, and we can only imagine the bitter emotion that overtook their mother and turned her joy into grief, and her yom tov was turned to mourning. God save us for her husband and daughters. She sat and wept all through Yom Tov without help, and the world actually turned dark for her, one cannot put into words her depressed state when she learned what had happened to her husband and daughters. She knew what awaited them. But remember that man for the good, the great and righteous man, who served God with true sacrifice in the full sense of the word, who in this time endangered his life, the great and pious Rav Shmuel David Unger, the head of the Nidra community, who did not rest and was not silent until he had redeemed these three captives at a great price. They went free and could return home to their house without any obstacle on the last day of Pesach. They let this woman of bitter spirit know immediately by telephone that her husband and daughters had emerged free and would return home the next day, Yisroelach, in peace and without obstacle. There is no need to tell the effect this great news had on the spirit of the bereft woman, knowing that her husband and daughters had emerged from between the lion's teeth in peace. From that moment, she waited with eyes failing with worry for the moment when the father and daughters would return to her home. The next day, she did not have the strength to wait for them at home. She sat at the entrance to the yard, her eyes looking out for the moment they would come. And when they came and she saw them, she burst out in a cry, pouring out all of the awesome emotion in her heart. She could not produce words of thanks to God for the magnitude of the miracle performed for her and for them, from the outpouring of feeling in her heart. One who did not witness the moment they actually met and saw each other again, mother with her daughters, after they returned from such a horrific captivity, and the mother's weeping when she saw that her daughters had returned home. And the joy of the mother of children at that moment never saw a feeling of joy. Therefore, since I know of that illumination which occurred in our days, so I imagine and describe the joy of our mother, the land of Israel, when all of us will return to her after such a horrific captivity which we have experienced at this time, and the amazing joy which the mother will experience with her children, meaning Israel with us and us with her. Therefore, I've named my book, Rejoice, Mother of Children.
Remarkable account, and that's what he's trying to get across, and what he tries to get across in the book itself. There is an English translation of the book Eima Banim Smecha available. The Hebrew, of course, is also available, and I certainly recommend it. But that's the idea that Rav Techtel tries to develop through many sources, some of which I brought here. This idea that Israel is more than just scenery and more than just real estate that's been promised to us, but it's actually a conscious, thinking, and feeling partner to us to whom we hope to return. Thank you very much.